Spoiler alert, Marc Marquez is still really good at the whole bike racing thing. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
That's my line. You took my line.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize you claimed trademark on it. Welcome to episode 590 of Motorsport 101, everybody. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Ray Harrison. Glad you could join us. And first of all, a small apology. This is going up on Saturday rather than our usual Thursday or Friday. Sincere apologies for that. These things happen. It's easy to forget that we all do have full-time jobs, and sometimes they do get in the way every once in a while. RJ's currently at Le Mans as we speak, doing an excellent job as usual, covering the 24 hours of Le Mans for racer.com and Daily Sports Cars. So, yeah, he's out there covering that, you know, and as a result, and a certain co-host had job difficulties at Apple. It happens sometimes. So it's a little bit later than usual. Sorry about that. It doesn't normally happen. We'll try to make sure it doesn't happen again. In the meantime, we do have a MotoGP race to talk about. It was the Grand Prix of Aragon, and it was a strange sort of weekend in the sense of watching that race on TNT was a bit like watching four people do a dance around a red Spanish-branded voodoo doll, sticking pins in number 93, trying to make him crash, to give them something interesting to talk about, and they failed miserably. But in other news, Marc Marquez was pretty much perfect. Isn't that right, Cameron Buckley?
Well, it's not like anyone gets any points for guessing who was going to win going into this Aragon weekend now, would they? We saw what happened here last year. Jorge Martin saw that man set the pace at the front of the field. Like, you know, I am taking second and I am getting the fuck out of Dodge. Whole lot of a repeat this year.
Certainly felt that way. Yeah, that's pretty much the long and the short of it, really. It's one of those Marquez tracks that we don't talk about so much when it comes to his dominance. We talk about Austin primarily, the Saxon Ring for obvious reasons of his 11 wins over there in all classes. Aragon goes a little bit under the radar, but you forget that he's won there 7 times, if you include his Moto2 victory there in 2012 as well.
Great, he has a corner here. He has a corner here, and he was making it everybody's problem every single lap.
Yeah, if there's one thing Marc Marquez likes more than anything other, it's a long, sweeping left-hander. And, yeah, man did it show over the course of the weekend, let me tell you. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. We'll be talking about the state of the title race as Alex Marquez took his pair of seconds and went home quickly. We'll be talking about Pecco Bagnaia, who may or may not have found a breakthrough to some of his struggles, but there was more pain before we got to that point.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, Pedro Acosta, in his latest feelings at KTM. We had a little test to get through as well, a couple of surprises to come out of that from the couple of tests we had over the week. And, well, we got the official confirmation on Tuesday. Toprak Razgatioglu will be a MotoGP rider in 2026. Earlier than expected, that announcement. We'll talk about that officially as well towards the end of the show. And we may even sprinkle in a little bit of Le Mans talk if you're feeling spicy. So without further ado, places you can find us real quick. We're on youtube.com/motorsport101. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. If you want to follow us personally on Blue Sky, you can do so at dreharrison.bsky.social and cbuckley917 at bsky.social. RJ is at RJ O'Connell. Same URL at the end. Of course, you can check out us on our website, motorsport101.com, for all the written blogs and bonus content over there. And if you like some video highlights of the show and some extra clips as well, you can do so on our two main video sites, Instagram and motorsport101pod. And we are now on TikTok at m101_podcast if you want to follow us on there as well. And of course, if you really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. Thank you very much for your continued support. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier, where you can listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded. You can also take a year at a 30% discount if you're that way inclined. Shout out to my new Patreon backer, James Stone Street, who backed us on as a monthly backer on Patreon. Thank you very much, James. Much appreciated. Thank you so much for your support. We do really appreciate it. Thank you. Right, without further ado, let's get into the Grand Prix of Aragon.
P is for priceless, the look upon your faces. E is for extinction, all your puny races. R for revolution, which will be televised. F is for how f***ed you are. Now allow me to reprise. E is for eccentric, just listen to my song. C is for completion that I've waited for so long. T is for the terror upon you I'll bestow. My name is Perfect Cell, and I'd like to say hello.
Aragon's tale was ultimately a simple one. Mark Marquez was perfect. For the first time since Mark himself did it in Germany 2015, another instance of that damn Spaniard. He led every single session across the weekend. That is FP1, FP2. What is PR here?
Practice.
Honestly, my brain is fried.
It's just practice.
Every practice, every qualifying, sprint race, and the race itself. If there was a time session, Mark Marquez led it. If there was a racing lap, Mark Marquez led most of them and all of the ones that mattered. He came back from a poor start to win the sprint on Saturday and put boots to asses about halfway through that sprint. In the race, Mark takes the whole shot, never looks back, and squeezes that lead out to a fairly comfortable 2.5 seconds with a casual Grand Slam victory. With Mark Marquez second in both races, the championship gap balloons out to 32 points, and with Pecco only managing third in the race after another scoreless sprint, he is now 93 points back in third.
Well, yeah, the beatings will continue until morale improves.
Morale has cratered.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird we're talking about a Marc Marquez victory when the last time he actually won a Grand Prix was 2 months ago. It's kind of weird the way these races have played out. We've got this was we had 3 races between Marc Marquez wins and he still won half the Grand Prix this season. It's kind of a weird feeling in a sense, but I mean, it really was as simple as this. Marc Marquez, from the moment he said his first time lap in practice, looked like he was going to be the man to beat. He pretty much had 3 temps on the field the whole weekend. Nothing, in my opinion, sums it up better than the end of timed practice on Friday, when Mark, at certain points in that session, was a second faster than the field. He didn't even bother with a final quali sim run at the end of the session to save an extra set of tyres. Alex Marquez got it to within 0.2, went to his media debrief on Friday, looked the journos dead in the eye and said, "Do you really think it's 0.2?
Yeah, Mark having not done a late lap on fresh tyres, so... the scarier part is that 3 tenths was basically all in sector 2. Mm. Every single lap just punching 0.3 seconds out on everyone who asked.
Yeah. Alex Marquez was crackers in sector 2. The turns 4 and 5, the corkscrew. Mm-hmm. He was really strong there. He's very good on the longer right-handers. That's where he apparently excels. But everywhere else, Mark was just shellacking the field.
But, barbecue chicken.
Yeah.
Yams, mac and cheese, fried catfish.
Yeah.
So on.
Sector 3 in particular, his corner, the run through to the chicane at the bottom of the hill, then the second chicane sequence back down the hill, Mark was 2 tenths faster than anybody else through there. He was just absolutely
at worst.
He was inhuman around that part of the track. He was completely untouchable. I mean, nothing, in my opinion, I think summed it up more than the sprint, where he did get a bad start. He did drop to fourth, got rubbed elbows with Pedro Acosta, immediately counter-attacked into turn one, got past Morbidelli relatively quickly, and the lap he really knuckled down to beat Alex. He took half a second out of him on that lap and then passed him into turn one, and that was it. Game over. Alex had immediately almost decided to settle for second because he had no chance with the difference in pace between them, and that was it, really.
Yeah, I mean, just the degree of comfort with which Mark could lap this place and lap this place so quickly. I mean, in race trim, he was reeling off fastest laps for fun in the second half of the Grand Prix, including a new track record, including a track record in qualifying. It just felt like he always had a whole lot more pace to dip into that, other than that middle portion of the sprint, we just never really saw. He didn't need to. Such was the degree of superiority. I mean, Alex will take some solace from the weekend of another pair of seconds. He minimizes the damage. The problem, again, stems from the fact that Mark has only really beat himself this year. No one else is beating him but himself. That really is the story of Mark Marquez's career at this point.
It certainly is. Yeah,
no one beats me but me.
Yeah, it's
really his career.
If there really was a retrospective on Mark Marquez's career, beating himself would be the headline and moniker of that book. Mm-hmm. It's weird because Mark was taking this seriously. I remember him talking to the media over the course of the weekend. He wanted to concentrate because he knew he'd made silly mistakes in previous rounds. He referenced Austin and the crash there. He referenced Jerez, a race he thought he could have won, but didn't. He knows he's thrown away 50 points in those two races. In his opinion, he threw away 50 points, and he knows that he should really be blowing this championship completely out of the water right now, and he's not. And he said he was in maximum concentration mode for this weekend, and I think that's why he was a little bit tentative at the start of both the sprints and the race. He was just determined not to make a mistake. I think some of the Ducati's GP25 problems were not being able to feel the front ends, probably a little element of that as well, where you just want to take no chances. But this pace was just so supreme, it ultimately just didn't matter in the end. He weathered that early storm, and then once he was comfortable, once again, back half of the race, completely untouchable. The one that stood out to me in the race, lap 19 of 21, sets a 46.7, the fastest ever lap of Aragon in race trim. And just like that, you know, it's an all-time lap record on a 19-lap-old rear tire. Just obscene speed. He had it completely in control the whole way through, and just utter dominance from Mark on that one.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's the amount of comfort with which he could do it, where he seemed to have a lap record in him at will. And I mean, when Mark is in that form, there's just not a whole lot you can do. Beyond that, kind of return to your regularly scheduled program of Ducati GP24/5, just lockout up top on the field.
Yeah.
After what was very much a blip in the radar at us in Silverstone, no, there is still no hope.
I want to say, what was it, 5 of the top 6? Jukes, only Acosta.
5 of the top 6.
Yeah, only Acosta breaching that mold. Well, we'll still talk about him in a little bit, but yeah. It's Mark's back in control, 32-point lead. Alex, again, took the maximum he could take from that as a damage limitation job. Again, he's been excellent this season. There is no bad rounds anymore. Alex is just good everywhere now.
I mean, Dre, I don't know if you saw the pace comparison year on year with very similar tires to last year. I believe in practice pace, Alex Marquez was 1.8 seconds faster compared to him on a GP23 a year ago. Mark about a second a lap faster compared to himself on a GP23. I mean, the bikes aren't changing that much, and they are still finding this much time.
Yeah, like the regulations are almost exactly the same as last year, and yet we're going a second and a half a lap faster. We're going faster than lap records are getting broken every weekend this season. It's been ridiculous how fast these bikes are. These are the quickest MotoGP bikes have ever been. And, well, we'll probably be saying that again next year before the 2027 regulation changes kick in. And even then, I don't know how much slower these bikes are actually going to be. We'll have to wait and see. The experts, like the Maddox, the world record, it's going to be 3 or 4 seconds a lap. And all I say is thank God. Because it scares me how rapid these bikes are nowadays.
Yeah, I'm not so sure we're going to get an 800cc prototype repeat where, oh, we took 200cc and they're faster.
Whoops.
Just on cornering speed. We're not going to see that this time. Yeah. Unless Pirelli brings something truly special to the table.
No, they make good bike in size. The Superbike paddock swears by them, but they're not going to be magically 4 seconds faster. No, not at all. So it is what it is in that sense. Pecco Bagnaia had an interesting weekend. I mean, once again, his struggles on the Saturday with the sprint tank continues. He qualified reasonably well in P4 and then just made a mistake. I mean, the bike just would not turn. One lap, he goes completely off the track at turn 6, the 90-degree right-hander, drops to 12th, and there was no coming back. At that point, Pecco Bagnaia was on a streak of 4 points in his last 5 races, if you include the sprints.
That's good.
It's not great, Bob. Luckily, a bit of overnight thinking from Ducati might have solved the problem. Turns out, all you've got to do, if you want to give Pecco Bagnaia some confidence, given his strongest element of his riding style is under braking, is put bigger brakes on the bike. They went from 345 to 360mm front brakes, and apparently that gave Pecco a lot of his confidence back, being able to brake into corners more comfortably, feel the front a little bit more on the GP25, and, well, it was probably the best he's looked all season, in race trim anyway.
Yeah, the problem is that he still got absolutely smoked by Marquez and Marquez the Younger. But, hey, at least he was third Ducati home, which is more than we've been able to say for the last, 2 months.
It's a step in the right direction. I mean, look, I don't know, because are Ducati going to keep this setup going? Because here's the thing, right? If you're Bagnaia, you're 93 points down. We're almost at the point where you say, F it, you've got nothing to lose at this point, because realistically, I don't think, to be fair, and Pecco's not an idiot, not even he's thinking about the title at this point. He's going to be thinking about just getting the feeling back of what he's, I mean, he said it himself to the press and media. He wants the feeling of last year back. He's not talking about challenging for the championship right now. And look, Pecco is a very well-rationed young man. He's not one of these people that's going to blow smoke up people's asses and tell them, yeah, we're going to go dominate this weekend. You know, he's not going to blow smoke up your ass. He's been very humble about this. He's been very honest about his struggles. I don't know if this has magically fixed the problem. And it's a huge round for him, because next weekend, we're at Mugello. He's gone undefeated in the last 5 races at Mugello, sprints and Grand Prix. He's on a 5-race winning streak on his own backyard. So this is a huge emotional round for Pecco. It's a home round. He's got the fans on board at Mugello. We saw it last year. There was a sea of red when he won that Grand Prix. People are starting to come around on Pecco Bagnaia in his own home country. And he's doing very well out there. If he loses this one to Marquez in a similar fashion, we really might be done here, because this is arguably Pecco's best track coming up. I mean, you can throw that about Assen as well, because Assen's a week later, the TT, and he absolutely dominated Assen last year. Had a super grand slam, led every single lap, sprint and Grand Prix. The next 2 weeks are huge for Pecco, Cam.
Yeah, I mean, that goes without saying. I mean, we said the same about Qatar, and Mark stuffed him in a locker there. So he really, I mean, are we going to see Mark Marquez on the blue Ducati?
I really,
Dre Harrison's wallet handle Mark Marquez on the blue Ducati.
I am not prepared. If they bring back the tricolor for another year, I'll be very aroused. I'm not going to lie to you. It's like that scene where Richard Hammond's in the tank and he busts through the house and he just goes, "Gentlemen, I'm going to be honest with you, I have an erection." That's what it would feel like. Yeah,
it's real.
Real.
Yeah. I don't know, because at no point this year, not a single one, has Pecco looked A, like his last year self, or B, anything like challenging Mark. And a huge element of that comes down to the fact that Mark will put a setup on the bike, go out, and he will just go bust the field up. And Pecco is much more particular, feels, in terms of setup of the bike, in terms of what allows him to achieve lap time out of it. And then Mark will just go bludgeon the front of the thing into the ground to go get a lap time out of it. He has got to be on it from FP1 in Mugello. I don't think he has a choice.
And Pecco's not the sort of guy that is strong at a race weekend right from the start. He builds over the weekend. It normally takes him a day to really figure out the setup. I mean, I've said it before, Pecco is a proper Goldilocks rider. He likes things just right. He's a very sensitive rider to feedback, and part of that is what makes him so good. But part of that also means he can be quite difficult to set up a bike for sometimes, because he's so dependent on how the front of the bike feels and how comfortable he is under braking, because that's how he generates his lap time. And that's been the biggest problem with the GP25. They've given up.
It's a little too numb.
Yeah, it's a little too numb. The GG Delinea and the developers behind that bike have basically decided, well, the GP24 is already one of the fastest, if not the fastest bike ever produced. Let's see if our riders can give up some of that rear end stability in exchange for speed. That's basically what this feeling has been all season. And as Cam said, that suits Mark Marquez down to the ground.
Mark will just go out and he'll tie the front of the bike into knots to go get a lap out of it, irrespective of what setup is on it.
Yeah.
It's just what he does. It's what he's done for over a decade.
He's made a career out of it, just bludgeoning the bike into doing what it wants to do. Sorry, an Aragon, that pole lap, that qualifying lap, that chicane up the hill.
He crashed. He just didn't drop the bike.
Right. That was the most violent.
Unbelievable to change of direction.
Yeah, there was the most violent snap of a change of direction I've ever seen in bike racing. I mean, the only one I've ever seen that was more violent was when Brad Binder crashed at Catalunya last year, when he turned it so hard, the rear came up off the ground. It was crazy.
Yeah, like, you know what happens usually when that happens? You high side the bike and you end up catching some air time. Record scratch, freeze frame, whole nine yards.
Yeah.
Mark said no and broke the track record with it.
Yeah.
It's what he does.
And compared out to Pecco, who is all about sensitive front ends and having a very, you know, specific feeling of how he wants his bike to feel, it doesn't suit what the GP25's game is and what it's trying to do in terms of how it generates lap time. That's why he struggled for most of this season so far. The 24 suited him down to the ground. Ducati,
24 suits everyone.
Yeah, because it's arguably the greatest MotoGP bike ever. Look what it's done to this. We talked about it before. Fermín Aldeguer's had a Grand Prix podium in his rookie season after just 6 starts. Alex Marquez has gone from fringe top 10 guy to genuine championship contender. Morbidelli's now a top 5 rider in the field again. Like, it's 2020 all over again.
Franco Morbidelli is closer to Pecco Bagnaia than Pecco Bagnaia is to either Marquez brother.
Yeah. Like,
better say that this time last year.
Yeah, the GP24 is the most user-friendly top-end bike we've ever seen. And Pecco, maybe this front-end, front brake bright change works, maybe it doesn't. The interesting thing is that we had a test on Monday. Fabio Di Giantonio tried the exact same trick, because he's also complained about the front-end feeling, and it didn't work with him. So, again, it could just be a very rider-specific feeling. It might just be a red herring. It could just be Aragon and the nature of it as a track. We just don't know. Mugello will probably give us a better indication of how that setup goes and how people are feeling about it. because if Pekka doesn't win in Mugello, it's probably over, quite in terms of any realistic title shot.
I mean, I don't think there's a realistic title shot no matter what happens from here on out. But he, like, to have any chance, he'd have to win out and blow the Marquez brothers into the middle of next week, the next two races. And that's I don't think that's going to happen.
And that's just the problem.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, like, that's just the problem. Even if Mark does have the occasional crash, which we all know he's been prone to doing over the years, Alex has been ultra consistent all season long. Alex is more likely to pick up the pieces than Mark, than Pecco is, because Pecco's been, at best, the third best Duke this season. Sometimes fourth.
Sometimes not even that. That's the concern.
Yeah, you've made a bike which is extremely fast. You know, I think at its ultimate, probably a little bit quicker than the GP24. But once again, you've put yourselves in a very similar situation to Honda, where only one man on the planet can fully extract that potential. Not exactly ideal, but hey, it helps when you've got the best bike in the field anyway.
Right.
KTM, I mean, look, KTM had a good weekend at least. Pedro Acosta.
One of them did.
Well, yeah.
One of them finished out well.
Well, yeah, I mean, Pedro Acosta was fourth. That was his best race weekend since Le Mans. Binder was right behind him.
Where was Brad Binder?
Crashed.
Where was Maverick?
Down the escape road.
Where was Anaya?
Nowhere.
That doesn't make a change, unfortunately. Yeah, it looked really good for KTM with a wad of bikes in the middle of the top 10, right up until the point where they started dropping like flies.
First time they had three bikes in the top 10 since Catalunya last year. Like, we thought, oh, okay, maybe KTM's made another step here. They qualified well. The race pace, well, Pedro proved that there was certainly
Never say that. Never say that. Never say KTM has made a step, because they always take that step back next round. Always.
Yeah. Once again, as I was about to say, it looks like they're taking a step forward, but then the next thing you know, they're not. And yeah, there's a lot of rumblings that Pedro's had enough. Like, there is murmurs and rumblings that Pedro's going to kick up a stink about his contract, because every media member I know who I can talk to in the paddock is all saying the same thing. Like, Pedro is putting a very brave face on things, but internally he is not happy. And he's fed up of telling the media, we've got to believe in KTM, we've got to believe in the project, you know, we'll get it figured out. Apparently, on the other end, in the week off, Maverick actually went to the factory in Austria and was trying to reassure people that they'll figure it out.
You have any idea how bad a relationship has to have soured when Maverick Vinales is the guy bringing people to the table, trying to sort things out? This guy blew up an engine deliberately a couple of years ago to get out of a contract.
Archbishop Desmond Vinales out here trying to bring the peace to KTM. What a time to be alive. When Maverick Vinales is the voice of reason, something has gone very wrong internally. That's the impression that I get. And again, we talked about this a little bit on our last MotoGP episode, how essentially KTM, I mean, their immediate future is secure. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Bajaj are now majority owners of KTM. I think it's 75% they now own, with an option to buy the rest. What's interesting is that Hervé Poncharal's made moves over at Tech 3. He stepped down as president of the IRTA. That's the team's association, for those who don't know. That's all the factories as a conglomerate. He was president of that group. He stepped down. Lucio Ceccanello has now taken that job, formerly the owner and boss of Team LCR. Also, there are now rumors going around that Hervé might be selling up, or at least selling a chunk. He's openly admitted he's talking with investors about the possibility of selling at least a minority stake of the team going forward. And the rumors are one of the main consortiums is one fronted by one former reality TV star known as Gunther Steiner. As you do.
Oh, great.
What the hell does Gunther Steiner know about owning the MotoGP team?
All I know is whatever bike he runs, they will start off very, very well. And then they'll bring upgrades. And then they won't.
Yeah, I just... Oof. I don't know.
Ghost like, Raptor says in our chat, what does Justin Marks know? Up to this point? That is a little bit concerning, given how Trackhouse has been this year.
I was going
to
say...
Iagura has been a bright spot in an otherwise kind of awful year.
I was going to say, like, here's the thing. Like, the thing about Justin Marks is, right, is that he openly knows he doesn't know how to run a MotoGP team. So he hired someone who does, and that's Davide Brivio. And we respect Davide Brivio, but just one problem. His team has been arse since they hired him. Like, Trackhouse were the third worst team on the grid last year, and they're the third worst team in MotoGP again this year. They're only 3 points ahead of the factory Honda team, who, let's be honest, have had one bike working for most of this season.
Yeah.
The only team worse than them has been Pramac. And, well, there's good reasons for that.
Yeah, they're brand new. The Yamaha is a messy bitch at the best of times. Unless Fabio Quartararo is riding it. And even then, messy bitch can strike that bike at any point.
It can indeed.
It's... Well, what is Gunther Steiner going to bring to MotoGP?
Drama. Because we all know that Liberty Media is well in the process of buying MotoGP. In fact, I've heard a lot of rumblings on the grapevine that there will be an announcement on that officially next week in the run-up to Mugello. They will announce that the purchase is done and that Liberty are going to own Formula One and MotoGP. And, well, the fact I've heard that teams are excited about the possibility of Gunther being in the paddock kind of says it all to me, that I think MotoGP are just reading off F1's copybook. And I think Liberty's going into this thinking, well, what worked for Formula One will just work for MotoGP. And I think they need to realize that MotoGP is starting from a much worse position than Formula One was when they bought them in 2016. Like, this is not just going to be a matter of making a reality TV show and then all the viewers will flock in, because, hey, the sport tried that, and I don't think anybody got excited about MotoGP Unlimited. I'm just saying. Has anybody talked about a season two? Does anybody care about the YouTube pieces they put out at the end of a season? There'll be only
this
one.
This is the part
it's a great series, but no one watches it.
Yeah, this is the part where you advertise it right alongside 100 Days to Indy on the CW. If an interesting TV show comes out and no one watches it, did it ever even release?
Might as well not have bothered in the UK when the initial release came out in Spanish only. True story, that happened on Amazon Prime. By the time they fixed it, no one cared anymore. And that's your third biggest market for bikes in the world, arguably in the UK. Good luck. Look, we'll see what happens. I think Hervé is thinking of an exit plan. I think these are the actions of a man who isn't sure KTM is going to be here beyond 2026. And when the CEO is openly admitting we'll be here in 27 if we can afford it, that doesn't exactly scream confidence.
No, it doesn't, does it?
And I've said it before, KTM's money is in off-roads and adventure biking, and they're able to do that and be successful on a chunk of the budget compared to running a MotoGP team at £70 million a year. Any smart creditor would be telling you, why are we in MotoGP again?
Winning. And it certainly isn't the taking part.
As my colleague Yuri Pujamont told me on Tank Slappers, we're paying an awful lot of money to show how we can lose. Not exactly what you call a positive look. One more thing before we get out of here, because I'm going to talk about this. It's official. Toprak is coming to MotoGP. We talked about it a little bit with rumblings in the air, but it was officially announced by Yamaha themselves on a factory contract. Toprak, Razgatlioglu, will be heading to MotoGP in 2026 with the Prima Pramac Racing team. Big deal, Cam. I mean, he is box office.
He finally got that Yamaha MotoGP seat. Just not at all the way we expected.
Four years after he tried the first time.
Yeah, Lynn Jarvis laughed him out of the fucking room without even giving him a chance.
Nope. The old management were like, who? new management was like, hey, we like him. So that was fun. Look, as a fan of bike racing, I love this. I'm a huge Top Rack admirer. And I've said this before, I think, and I'll say it again. He is to World Superbikes what Valentino Rossi was for MotoGP in the early 2000s. People are going out of their way to go to Grand Prix weekends to watch Top Rack race. He is huge for that series. He is box office. He is incredibly entertainment. He is everything you could wish in a star coming over to MotoGP, because he has been the star of World Superbikes for the last 4 years now. Some of those fights he was having with Jonathan Rea and Alvaro Bautista, it was a golden era of World Superbike racing, and he was the vocal point of that. He's won two championships. He's got a good chance of taking a third. It's going to be a blood fight between him and Nicolò Buliga for the crown this year, given the Panigale's a bit stronger on paper. But
a bit.
Well, if you know.
A bit. Yeah, echo everything you just said. I mean, Top Rack is as box office as it comes. I mean, we said many years ago on a season review, I'd be fine just watching Marc Marquez just hot lap a racetrack. Exactly the same, copy and paste for Top Rack. He is phenomenally exciting to watch. Unfortunately, he's coming in on the last year of the Michelin tires. He's going to put one braking zone in on a set of Michelins and go, what the hell is this?
It's a strange one. The timing on this is peculiar. I mean, there was a lot of... I mean, a few months ago, the rumors were...
I disagree. I think it makes perfect sense.
How so?
He gets a year in MotoGP to get used to it before the new bikes come in, before the new tires come in.
It's going to be weird, though, having to acclimatize to a prototype on Michelins and then having to go to Pirelli a year later and basically start over again. It's going to be a little bit weird, though, isn't it?
Maybe. I mean, he could have said the same about Lewis Hamilton going to Mercedes. That worked out real fucking well for everyone involved.
Well, yeah, it took him a year, but once he really got going, I mean, yeah, it was a lot. It's a strange one.
What's the God engine is about?
Yeah, it's a strange one. I mean, look, he's going to get given every chance to succeed. He's already bringing his crew chief with him. He's going to get, apparently, a private test before the end of the MotoGP season ends at the end of the year, before Valencia's, you know, end of season, you know, 2026 test, if you want to call it that, whatever. You know, apparently Yamaha are going to use their concessions to help get him up to speed, depending on if they're still in Tier D.
Right call.
Yeah.
Yamaha are in a very unique position to try and pull this off, the switch, because they have the concessions, because they are looking at effectively resetting their bike around the V4. We actually got to hear the V4. We got to hear it in a test bike the other day. It sounds like a racing V4. It's one of the greatest sounds you can hear in racing. Cry about it if you disagree. And if Yamaha are smart, because look, irrespective of what Fabio is doing on that bike, and it is knucking futs what he has been able to do on that bike these last couple months, they're not in title contention.
No.
You dump every single resource, and if there's one thing Yamaha has as a company, it is money and time, and dump it into the 2027 prototypes. Everything, all in on the V4 in the 850ccs. They've got the test time, and now they have someone to build around beyond Fabio as well.
I hope so. I mean, we just don't know what this is going to be. And that's the only real concern I have about this move going into it. It's the sort of move where it could go brilliantly if Toprak's able to convert his natural talent and his ability into riding a MotoGP prototype, because he's one of the two people on this planet who can do things on a motorcycle that no one else on Earth can do, quite frankly. That X factor could be worth something in GP form. It could also be an unmitigated disaster if he can't adapt to it.
Absolutely.
We've seen, you know, Jack Miller has struggled this year at times. Miguel Oliveira, who is one of the most versatile bike riders in the field, a man with 5 MotoGP wins to his name, has been awful this season. And there's a lot of murmurs he's going to be the one sacrificed for Toprak's contract in the first place. That's the rumblings I've heard. And if that's the case, one, it would be a very sad way for Miggy to potentially go out. He's a phenomenal bike rider. He's an incredibly gifted guy. If you want an unluckier bike rider in the world, you'd be hard pushed to find one worse than Miggy, quite frankly. But it could be Pramac clean to the decks. I mean, we found the news out earlier this week that Alvaro Bautista will not be coming back to the factory Ducati World Superbike team. Ducati decided to move on from him. Bautista wanted to stay, but they're not going to keep him. And there's rumblings that they might be trying to get Jack Miller in alongside Nicolò Müller. It would make a lot of sense for Jack. Right. He's done a lot in MotoGP.
Hell of a lineup over in World Superbike.
It's a powerhouse lineup. Like, him sliding the Ducati around would make perfect sense for Jack. He's got a new family to look after. Only been married less than 2 years. Got a child that's barely a year old. It's a much more reduced schedule compared to MotoGP. It makes a lot of sense for Jack to maybe go over there if he's not like the Yamaha, if GP's not worked out. Ducati will pay him big money to go on a Panigale instead and basically ride half a year and spend much more time with his new young family around him. It makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. We'll have to wait and see. But certainly an exciting time for MotoGP. Like I said, I can't wait to see how Toprak gets along. It's a dream move.
It will not be boring. There is no outcome of this that will be boring, good or bad.
That is a guarantee. I can promise you that. Holy hell. Whatever happens with Toprak, it will not be boring. We'll be back next week for more on MotoGP at Mugello, for the Italian Grand Prix. Let's hope it's actually a good one. We've not had a good Italian Grand Prix in a few years now, annoyingly, because it's not even Pecco. It's just been so goddamn dominant at the front for the last few years.
It was good last year. The bike just looked that good.
Yeah, it helps. It softened the blow, so to speak. Cam, before we get out of here, what's your pick for Le Mans? What's your feeling now? We have a Cadillac 1-2.
I got a strong feeling about Scuderia Cameron Glickenhaus taking the overall this year.
Did you get off the narcotics and give me a real answer?
Who did you pick?
51.
I picked the 51 just so if you go down, if I go down, you go down with me.
Oh, it's like this now, is it?
Look, I make no bones about it. I have no expectations for this race. I think Ferrari sandbagged the piss out of qualifying.
You really think so?
Sebastian Bourdais does.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, he said, like, yeah, they're laughing at us. That was his exact quote.
I love Seabass. I love Seabass so much.
hell of a front row with Cadillac. I mean, Porsche look really good on the long runs. They look kind of a little bit more raceable car this year than last year. It wasn't like Kevin Estra last year with his wheel upside down into turn one to get the thing on pole.
Oh, yeah.
But we'll see. I'd love to say that Porsche is going to win this race, but I know better.
And well,
hopefully this ages poorly.
Well, I've got a title to defend. I've picked the last two Le Mans winners correctly. I picked the Rolex 24. I'm 3 for 3 in my last 24-hour pick selections.
At this point, we should stop giving out points for Porsche winning in IMSA, because Jesus Christ, it's been an unmitigated bloodbath this year.
A waste of time.
They put that thing up 30 kilos on the most of the rest of the field in Detroit, and they still got third and fourth.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't much of a contest either. Yeah, Ferrari looked great. I was a bit surprised about their qualifying speed. I don't know how much of that was them sandbagging or just taking no chances. Seabass was adamant that that's the case. We'll have to wait and see when the race actually gets going.
Say nothing of Toyota. Nyck de Vries, you are not beating the allegations. How dare you make that car look that good and go that slow?
Kimi Kobayashi has basically given up his frontline role of that car to Nyck de Vries, and it's not worked out.
You have Kamui Kobayashi. You have Kamui Kobayashi for qualifying at Le Mans. You decide not to use him.
Mm-hmm.
What is the point?
Yeah. And hey, we got Caddy's front row. Jota 1-2 at the front of the field. Alex Lynn as a Le Mans pole sitter. Jack Aitken set the fastest ever hypercar lap of Le Mans in Hyperpole 1. Is this real, Cam, with Caddy's?
I think the problem for Cadillac is that the lap time is real, but the top speed isn't. They are phenomenally quick through all the cornering sections. As the modern Cadillac prototypes have always been, they have terrific downforce. They have terrific power delivery. They can get up out of corners quick, but they are getting shot to pieces in a straight line, especially by the Porsches. And that is, you can get lap time out of a car at Le Mans any way you want these days. It's not the racetrack it was back the last time an American car sat on pole there in 1967. But if you want to race and if you want to actually fight with people, you got to have more straight line speed. So I think they'll be competitive, but I don't know how they're going to race. I think Porsche has a very raceable car. I think Toyota always has a very raceable car at Le Mans. They always do. It is their bread and butter. So long as Jose Maria Lopez isn't driving the car in the clutch. And I think Ferrari will, frankly speaking, come chainsawing through the field.
You know who RJ O'Connell down at Le Mans has picked, right? You know?
No.
Number 8.
Of course he did. Homer.
It's the intelligence.
Not only was he a homer, not only did Sebastian Buemi just screw qualifying for that car because he did make it in the hyperpole and then fucked it on his fast lap.
Mm.
If I'm going to pick a Toyota, it's like you always have to have a Toyota pick in case they don't get the cartoon anvil thrown on them this year. I got to pick the 7, and it is on nothing but vibes and that beautiful, beautiful paint. Unfortunately, if that paint is if that's channeling the energy of the TSO20, that thing's going to grenade a gearbox with 50 minutes to go with two Porsches bearing down on it.
It would be the way it would go out. If it's going to go out in any way, that's the way it should go out, quite frankly, in a blaze of glory.
Look, the TSO20 is famous for one thing and one thing only.
Explosions.
Being the best damn car to never win a race.
I was going to say,
the world's most famous loser, and I still love it anyway.
Well, I said it could be worse. It could be Peugeot.
Oh! Oh!
I love that John Eric Verne made no bones about it. We have no chance, is what he basically said.
If we're going to separate this off into its own little nugget of a Le Mans preview, I mean, Peugeot, usually the B-spec Peugeots whoop a whole lot of ass at Le Mans. This car has not done that.
No,
and you know what I think after Spa, what really this hypercar field needed was Ferrari to get a major buff and Peugeot to get nerfed.
Yeah,
I think that's what the field needed.
I mean, Jeff does not care if he gets fined. He was just straight up, the BOP is fucked. This is what he basically said in a slightly more polite manner. He does not care if he gets fined.
I don't think he should have been polite. Look,
the
9X8 has got enough issues on its own. The BLP ain't helping either.
No, it's not. I mean, okay, before we get out of here, Cam, are you definitely saying 51? Because Jason will write this down.
If I'm going down, you're going down with me. But no.
How dare you?
No, I will not tie myself to this ship. No, purely on vibes. I don't believe it will happen, but I want it to happen, and that's enough. The Triple Crown has never happened in 1 year.
The Tandy Man?
Not in endurance racing. Give me the number four. It looked terrific in race trim. I would have picked the six, but them cheating Penske's appears to transcend all lines of series.
It's just
silly happens. Fuckers.
Silly fuckers. The Tandy Man. You know what? I'm glad you did. I'm glad you stuck to your guns. And if in doubt, go for the Calendar Triple Crown. If you're not, and to be fair, not just for Nick Tandy, but for Felipe Nazar as well.
Yeah. Keep in mind, Nick Tandy and Felipe Nazar. And you know how fucking cool it would be if Pascal Wehrlein won Le Mans debut?
Oh, sexy.
Awesome. I don't believe in this whatsoever. I was actually going to do a protest pick of the Wayne Taylor Cadillac number 101. Purely on how fucked I thought the BOP was going to be going into this race, but it's actually turned out quite great. Broken clock twice a day, etc., with the ACO and FIA on that one. Yeah. Also, a real Toyota hydrogen prototype.
Mm.
It's cool as shit.
Cool as hell. Looking forward. I hope it's in Garage 56 in a couple of years' time. That'd be cool as shit.
Yeah. Because like, have you ever heard the hydrogen GR Corolla?
I haven't, no.
You ever heard it? It's amazing.
Mm.
Well, sounds so rumbly. Also, Mr. Toyota wafting the exhaust fumes onto his head. Because it's just water vapor.
Yeah, it's just like, this is clean. No, that sounds like a lot of fun. Garage 56, the greatest race on earth, the 24 Hours of Le Mans this weekend.
We have all completely stuck to party lines. You with Ferrari, me with Porsche, RJ with Toyota.
That's how it should be.
Now we just need some sicko in the Discord to pick an Aston Martin.
Sure, why not? I look forward to Ghost Raptor picking the 007 out of spite. The greatest race on earth, the Le Mans 24 Hours this weekend. In fact, it'll probably be just about starting by the time this episode goes up. We'll be back to review that next week, as well as Formula One's Canadian Grand Prix and IndyCar at Gateway, the dumbest race placement of the entire calendar year. All of that and more on next week's loaded set of M101 recordings. Until then, I've been Jay Harrison, they've been Cam Buckley. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Where's Pedro going?
VR46, anyone?